So a few days ago, it's around 2:30 a.m., and I'm not asleep, and I know I should be. I've known for about 3 hours, but I'm lying there scrolling through something. I'm not even sure anymore. And then I'm watching a video about a kitchen renovation in a house that I'll never own. And I'm actually watching it like it somehow matters. And there's this moment sometimes where I catch myself just for a second scrolling in the dark. And I think, what the hell am I doing? Why am I doing this? It's not dramatically. It's more like this low-level, persistent confusion. Like, it's like noise in the walls that you've just learned to ignore. And I had this thought that, you know, humans have built something genuinely strange. We've built this existence where more stuff is available to more people than at any point in history. And yet, the dominant mood seems to be this vague, low-grade dread that nobody really has a name for. It's not depression or anxiety exactly. It's just kind of a hollowness that the next thing that you buy or that you watch or scroll through or whatever it is, it almost fixes. Almost. Now, here's the part that really irks me. You're born. You have no say in it. There's no instructions. You don't get to choose your name. There's really no one to walk you through what you didn't even actually sign up for. And somehow, before you've done a single thing, there's already a tab running. There's already a fee for existing. You're issued a number by the government. And before you know it, you're signing documents and you're paying taxes, you're paying rent and bills and so on. You're essentially paying to exist. Now, a bird, on the other hand, for example, just wakes up and builds a nest, and there's no permits necessary. No one comes by to inspect it. Or I don't know, how about a coyote walking up to a stream and it takes a drink? Nobody stops it. A cat finds a warm patch of sun on the floor, wherever, and it just stays there. It has no guilt about it. No internal voice asking whether it's being productive enough with its time. Now, humans, on the other hand, we don't really get that, do we? We call ourselves human beings, but it seems like the being part, it got quietly phased out somewhere along the way. So what we're left with is the doing and proving, earning your place and, you know, justifying your existence. Now, you can exist, but you damn well better have a reason for it and the means to pay for it. And should you decide that you would prefer a smaller, simpler life, and not even anything extreme, it's just something mellower. You know, a little plot of land to grow some food, build something with your own hands. Keep mostly to yourself. Become self-sufficient. That's when the complications start. The zoning codes, the permits, the property taxes, someone in an office or now an algorithm, deciding whether the life you want is an approved life. It's not about danger or safety. It's about whether you're still participating. And if you're not, if you try to just live without being plugged into the machine 24/7, people get uncomfortable with this. Like you broke some rule that nobody remembers or agreeing to in the first place. And of course, they're going to call this laziness. But it doesn't feel like laziness inside, because deep down it feels like something inside of you remembering that this isn't really how it's supposed to be. So I guess you could say you're free from a certain perspective, a certain context. You're just not free to opt out. Every other animal just exists inside the world it was born into. But apparently, we are the one species that needs supervision and justification. And so we became consumers and users. So let's sit with those words for a minute. So, to consume is to use something up, burn through it. And a user, well, that's also what we call someone with a drug problem, right? And somewhere along the way, we took the basic biological fact that we need to eat and survive, and we turned it into a personality, into a civic function of sorts. It was turned into something you could be good at or bad at. There's this grainy footage from the late 1940s that you've probably seen without really paying attention to it. There's people in high-waisted trousers pouring molten steel in a factory. You've got people on assembly lines clicking parts together with pretty much the same motions all day long. And yeah, it looks rather miserable. It's loud. It's dirty. The air probably tasted like metal and cigarettes and whatever they used to clean the floors. But if you look a little closer, there's something in the faces that's hard to place, something that feels, I don't know, gone now. So back then, the name that was given to a worker was something along the lines of value creator, which sounds like a LinkedIn buzzword now, but it meant something concrete. So you were a builder, a producer. You were the actual cell that made the organism move. And because of that, you had a certain weight in the world. Now, it wasn't dignity in some abstract philosophical sense. It was just weight. You had real leverage where you weren't reduced to a decimal point on someone's spreadsheet. So This meant that you were the one who could walk off the job with 500 other people and bring the whole machine to a grinding stop. That was a fact. And everyone knew it was a fact, including the guy who owned the machines. I think there's something that gets lost when we talk about that era. People like to romanticize it, you know, or they just dismiss it. And, well, either way, I think they miss the thing that actually mattered, which wasn't that life was necessarily good. I mean, it wasn't good in a lot of ways. I mean, the work was brutal. The hours were long. Sadly, a lot of people died who, you know, doing things that shouldn't have killed them. But the relationship between a person and their society had a certain legibility. You could actually see where, how you fit. You could see that your absence, or what your absence would cost. And people knew their neighbors, because their neighbor was likely to be the guy on the line next to them at work. They didn't know him because you liked him necessarily, or because some app suggested you might have things in common. You knew him because you both showed up to the same place at the same time every day, and the reality was is that your survival loosely intertwined with his. So if the roof of the local school was leaking, it wasn't a budgetary line item that got forwarded around between consultants in a different time zone. This was where your kid sat and where his kid sat. And for the most part, problems were local and visible and shared by people who had to look at each other face to face. Crazy, right? So there was a kind of horizontal gravity where people pulled toward each other, not necessarily out of warmth, but out of just having a pretty clear-eyed understanding of the basic arithmetic. Unions were built on the simple math that solidarity meant power. And they worked imperfectly, yes. You know, they had their problems. Sometimes, you know, even violently, but for the most part, they worked. Because in simple terms, the people who owned things understood that the people doing things, making things, had the ability to stop doing them. Now, unfortunately, that's the part that gradually got engineered away over time. So somewhere in the 1980s, the gravity shifted direction more noticeably. And it was discrete at first, but then it was like all at once. The value creator got some new job titles, such as expense, liability, a human resource, which is a phrase that should unsettle you more than it probably does, in my humble opinion. So think about what it's actually saying. It's saying that you are a resource, like lumber, like ore. You are something to be extracted from until it's used up and then written off and discarded. So the CEO, who used to make maybe 20 times what the guy on the floor made, who lived in a bigger house, yes, but probably ate at the same restaurants and sent his kids to the same schools and breathed the same air. That gap started growing massively, and it didn't stop. 30 times, 100, 300, 500 times the pay of the person actually making the thing. And, you know, at a certain point, the numbers stop meaning anything because it's not even, they're not even in the same ecosystem anymore. And the strange part, and the part that still gets me when I think about it, is that we didn't let this happen passively. We got paid off, in a sense. Not well, but just enough to keep quiet about what was happening. So this payoff came in the form of there was a booming materialism, and, you know, it was low prices at the big box stores, maybe a sandwich that cost less than a gallon of gas. So basically it was the implicit promise that as long as you could buy a flat screen TV on a Tuesday afternoon without thinking too hard about it, you were participating in something called prosperity. The government stopped promising careers or communities or any kind of stake in the thing. And they started promising deals, affordable goods, consumer confidence, etc. And as long as the prices stayed low enough and the shelves stayed full, the story went that we were winning. This is what winning looked like, I guess. So we gave up a seat at the table for a shopping cart. And somewhere in that trade, a certain word disappeared. The word citizen became customer. And a customer doesn't have allies or any leverage. A customer really has no recourse except to take their business elsewhere, which is fine when you're choosing between phone plans, but it's a different thing entirely when it's your life. You know, we like to tell ourselves that this was all natural evolution, that, you know, one day collectively humanity just looked at what came before and decided that the cubicle was an upgrade. But I think if you actually take a good look at the history, it looks a lot more like it was a forced march than a natural progression. So, for example, if we go back to European feudalism, before the Industrial Revolution and all the factories, there were the commons, shared land, forests, fields, waterways that didn't belong to anyone in particular and got managed by everyone in general. Now, I know this probably sounds like something from a fantasy novel, but the thing is, even under a feudal lord, a peasant had a strange kind of autonomy that we've completely lost track of. They had direct access to the earth. They were connected to nature. Their tools were their own. Their time was within limits their own. They actually had more free time than we do, believe it or not. I'm not saying that, you know, feudalism was some utopian thing. That's not what I'm saying. But they didn't need a paycheck to eat because the means of eating weren't behind a paywall yet. But then came the enclosures. So between the 15th and the 19th centuries, the ruling classes started putting up fences, literally. They put up millions of acres of shared land, converted to private property with a few strokes of a pen in Parliament. And that wasn't even just a real estate transaction. That was the deliberate, systematic destruction of self-sufficiency. So the fences were up, or once the fences were up, you basically had two options at that point. Sell your labor to the people who just took your land, or become like a vagrant. And the state made it, well, they made sure that vagrancy was a criminal offense. Isn't that nice? You could be branded for it. And I'm not talking about marketing here. You could be imprisoned. You could even be hanged. So you weren't just robbed of your means of survival. You were then hunted just for being poor. And, you know, when the factories started coming, people, they didn't walk into these mills smiling. They fought against this. They tore down the fences. They formed communes. They launched rebellions. And, of course, the response was brute force. So we didn't really transition into industrial capitalism. We were more accurately conscripted into it. And the reason that any of this matters now is that it reframes what happened later on in the 1980s, because the 80s were like a modern version of the enclosure. So feudalism took the land. But the modern version took the culture. So it gutted the unions and dismantled the safety nets, and it effectively retired the concept of the citizen as a person with a stake in the collective. And it replaced it with the concept of the consumer as someone who expresses themselves through purchasing decisions. So the goal here wasn't just your labor this time. It was your total dependency. Because a worker who owns his tools, that's a problem. A customer drowning in debt for things he didn't need last year is, from a certain angle, perfectly manageable. And, you know, we were taught to see this arrangement, selling your hours just to afford a place to stand, as a law, like it was just a law of nature or something, like it was the weather. But it wasn't. It was built by specific powerful people through specific and usually violent choices. So in a sense, the low price was really just, that was the last fence. And we gave up what autonomy we did have left for a cheaper television, and we didn't even notice that we were handing over the deed. So now we're here, And the fences aren't made of wood anymore, of course, because now we've moved into something that functions more like a low-grade psychological war, except nobody declared that war. And there's no clear, tangible enemy. And most people are frankly just, they're just too tired to even notice that they're in it. We don't really buy things to use them anymore. We buy things, well, a big part of why we buy things now is to broadcast and post them. It's almost like we're inadvertently advertising. So we buy things to maintain some ongoing argument that we're doing fine, actually. That we've, won something. Though nobody can quite say what that is exactly. And I get it. Because there's a little dopamine thing that happens when you put something new in a room and you photograph it before you've even used it. It's not stupid. It's just been engineered very carefully. I think consumerism at its core, it's an atomizing force because it turns the person next to you into a competitor. And you're not really going to organize with someone that you're quietly trying to out-consume. If I'm measuring myself against your kitchen renovation, I can't really see you as someone I share a problem with. So what happens is the comparison kills the coalition before it even starts. And now, you know, the digital layer has made all of this pretty much frictionless. Now, at this point, we're basically tribal animals that got handed a machine that simulates tribe while quietly replacing it. And the algorithm, it just gives you just enough connection to feel like you're not alone. And just enough comparison to make sure you never feel like you're enough. That's a fancy little trick, isn't it? So now we're like the lab rat pressing the lever for the sugar pellet, except the pellet is like from someone you went to high school with and haven't thought about in decades. And now it's going even further thanks to the subscription model. I mean, you've probably noticed by now that ownership is becoming a thing of the past. There was a time when you used to own a movie or an album, a record. You even used to own digital software. And I understand that in some ways, renting is more sustainable and reduces waste and all that. But in other ways, this is, you know, the subscription model it's really further entrenching us into a state of the eternal bill that never gets paid off. Now, this, of course, just intensifies privacy concerns and endless data harvesting. So now you rent your music, you rent your tools, your software, your movies, you rent your modem. There are now cars on the road where the heated seats are physically installed, but they're locked behind a monthly fee. The hardware's there. You just can't use it unless you subscribe. So this is the enclosure pretty much completed. They fenced off the land and then the culture. And now they're working on ownership itself as a concept. The idea that a thing that you paid for is yours, that's becoming historical. And I think what this creates is a kind of permanent low-level panic. Think of a treadmill with no off switch. That's what we're on at this point. And if you want to be a rebel and stop paying, well, then your library disappears. Your software locks, the tools you built your work around become inert, unusable. So it's not really a matter of being behind on rent anymore. You're just behind on existing. A person in chains in 1850 could look at the horizon and imagine something else. It was a real horizon. It was out there. But the thing that's got you now lives in your pocket. It knows your sleep schedule. It knows what you're looking at 3 a.m. when you think nobody's watching. It curates your anxiety, and then it sells you the remedy, and there's no outside to escape to because you've built the inside around yourself one subscription at a time. You know, the stuff we buy is almost besides the point now, because it seems to me that the scarier thing is what's happening to the way we think. So at some point, and I can't tell you exactly when, capital logic got inside. Not as an ideology people consciously adopted, more like a gradual atmospheric change. Sort of like the way a room gets stuffy and nobody mentions it because it happens gradually and now it just feels like the air. Ask someone why they're going to college. Really ask them and sit with the answer. Now, almost nobody says anything about curiosity or understanding the world. They talk about job markets, starting salaries, return on investment, career tracks, and so forth. And some of the pragmatic stuff, I totally get it. But humans have pretty much turned the human brain into a commodity before it's even finished forming. And at some point, I think the question changed from, what do I want to learn? To what are you going to do with that degree? And it doesn't stop there because the logic just followed us home. So hobbies became side hustles. Rest became recovery time, recharging, people call it. Like you're just a device that needs to be plugged in before the next shift or whatever. I mean, even sleep got productivity hacked. We've got apps for that now. You know, optimize your sleep, track your deep cycles. Make sure that your unconscious hours are performing adequately. And of course, we did this to relationships too. I mean, look at how people talk about dating now. The language is like portfolio language. It's a job interview. There's green flags, red flags, assessing someone's value, their stability, their monetary situation, their, I guess, brand alignment with your own projected future. And people say things like, I don't have the bandwidth for that now about other human beings. And it doesn't even sound strange anymore. It's because it's been normalized. The master got internalized so completely that we became our own HR departments, which means that we basically performance review ourselves now. We audit. It's like we audit our friendships for return on investment. We feel genuine guilt about unproductive days, like we failed a quarterly target or something. And I think the threat that keeps all this running, it's not violence. It's the fear of being nothing. Because if you try to opt out, if you stop performing productivity, stop consuming, stop signaling, the question that surfaces is pretty ugly. The question of who are you without all this stuff? The stuff that owns you. You know, who are you without the subscriptions and the side hustles and the carefully curated evidence that you're doing fine? I mean, most people do not want to face this, understandably. If you strip the customer away, is there actually a person underneath, or just a habit that got out of hand? And that's not a very comfortable question to sit with, which is exactly why the TV stays on and why the phone comes out the second that there's a pause in conversation. And it's also why 2 a.m. finds you watching kitchen renovations videos with your thumb still moving. You know, the ideal prison doesn't really need guards. It just needs inmates who are terrified of what real silence feels like. So this is a phrase that gets thrown around, end of history. And it's basically this idea that we've arrived and that democracy and consumer capitalism are the final form, the destination humanity has been moving toward all along. And it's not perfect, obviously, but it's settled. It's done. I don't think we stopped because we found the best way. I think we stopped because we found the hardest one to argue with. And it's difficult to organize against a system that gives you same-day delivery and a personalized feed and then calls that freedom. At this point, the cage is climate controlled. But The door is actually open. The problem is that you can't afford to walk out. And the thing that makes it stick, you know, the actual mechanism, is that we've been taught to want this. And not even reluctantly, enthusiastically. I mean, we actually defend this at dinner parties, and we feel proud of our consumption in ways that we would be embarrassed about if we actually examined it closer. The anxiety that the system creates and the relief the system sells ultimately come from the same place. And somewhere in that loop, the question of whether any of it was ever a choice, it gets very hard to find. And unfortunately, there's no clean way, or simple or clean way to end this. And there's nothing really to do with this realization except, I guess, have it, accept it, and then probably, you know, pick up the phone again because it's there. And the alternative is just lying in the dark thinking about it, which maybe is the point. Maybe the thinking is the thing they can't sell you just yet. It's, you know, the moment before the next purchase, the next hit of almost enough. That, you know, that gap and that uncomfortable silence, it doesn't feel like freedom. If it just feels like, I guess, being awake. And I'm not even sure that's better. But I guess it's something. And I don't know what else to say about this subject right now. So I guess that's going to be it for me today. As always, thanks for listening.